new in the topic of hyperkalemia.
The patient can be completely asymptomatic, and so we'll have no clue.
If they're bradycardic and have hyperkalemia, that's bad.
They can even present as cardiac arrest.
It's a quintessential emergency department diagnosis that all of us have to manage.
This can eventually progress to the EKG of doom.
Welcome, everyone, to Critical Care Perspectives in Emergency Medicine. As always, this is Mike Winters from the University of Maryland School of Medicine, coming to you from Baltimore, Maryland. I hope all of you are doing well. This podcast, really looking forward to this month's educational topic, a topic that we see, well, I'm going to say every day in the emergency department and in the ICU. So an extremely important topic. But prior to doing that, I got to introduce, as always, my amazing co-host, as I've said before, the brains behind CCPEM, Dr. John Greenwood, Dr. Peter W., and Dr. Rob Rodriguez. John, I'm going to start with you this time. How are things as we head into this podcast?
Things are great. We just moved into a brand new home, which required us to transport 70% of our critically ill patients from our old hospital to our new hospital in Philadelphia, which was quite a task. Went off unbelievably without a hitch. We were anticipating all the bad things that could happen, and fortunately, we got through unscathed. So it's been an incredible weekend and week, and everything's going great.
Well, sounds like planning went well if there were no patient safety events or adverse events and moving all those people over to the new facility. So let us know how it goes. We'll check back in with you when we reconnect for another podcast, how the new facility is. Peter, New Orleans, how are you this time?
I'm doing well. Finally getting some cool weather and, you know, just in time for COVID going down. And so things have loosened up within the state and within the city in regards to mask mandates. And so things at the hospital are looking more normal, not normal, but closer to normal.
Sounds excellent. And Rob, we'll head from New Orleans out to San Francisco. How's the West Coast this recording?
I would say ditto to Peter's evaluation. We also are getting some cool weather, finally getting some rain, which is desperately needed out here. And in the hospital, our COVID numbers are low, and our ED is now full of what we used to see before COVID. Lots of trauma, lots of MI strokes, and other critical illness.
Yeah, I think you're hitting on something that I think we're all seeing across the U.S. at least, and probably even in international settings, much of what we were used to seeing pre-COVID. Sprinkled in with a little bit of COVID, numbers are lower, as the three of you indicated, but also, like we had said before, and John so eloquently acknowledged our nursing colleague, we're still getting through the staffing shortages. So hopefully things are starting to improve on that front. We're recording this just a few days after ACEP's scientific assembly. So for those of you that got a chance to travel to Boston, those of you that watched online, hope it was a great experience. Thanks to those of you that came up to each of us to say hello. It was great to be in person and just very sort of enjoyable. My time was brief at ACEP, but we're back now. And since you mentioned the weather, we're scraping some ice off the windshield heading into the hospital, some frost. So weather's definitely turning and fall is in the air. Well, Dr. Greenwood, I'm going to turn things over to you for this month. You're going to be our MC, taking us through this important topic that I alluded to, but perhaps you can get into some specifics.
Absolutely, Mike. So a lot of times on this podcast and when we teach and everything, we go into these really complex resuscitation topics, but those tend to be a little less common. And it's always good sometimes to go back to the things we see every day. And what reminded me of this was a patient encounter I had probably a week or two ago. It was a 65-year-old gentleman who, in triage, complained of nausea, vomiting, weakness, classic, right? Like, it's what we see all the time. Got into triage, had some vital signs, and had a heart rate of 30. Got his EKG, and it was a junctional rhythm. And he had a normal blood pressure at the time, was brought back to the emergency department to one of our resuscitation areas because he initially had a heart rate of 30 and it kind of stayed in the low 30s. And his blood pressure was actually a little bit on the lower side by the time he got back. And we rapidly established IV access, And on his initial blood gas, there were definitely some abnormalities, and not necessarily the ones we expected, but with the complaint of nausea, vomiting, weakness, could be anything, with a new bradycardia that was kind of odd looking on the EKG. On his blood gas, his potassium was actually 8. It was a great teaching case. Fortunately, the patient did very well. And it reminded me, hey, let's go back. What's new in the topic of hyperkalemia? Is there anything that's changed over the past decade since maybe I've learned about this in residency a while back? So the plan for today is going to be to discuss hyperkalemia. And there's a great review article that was published in the Journal of the American College of Emergency Physicians just a few weeks ago, interestingly enough. And it was written by Zubaid Rafiq, as well as a number of other physicians who are emergency physicians, nephrologists, cardiologists. And their goal was to put together an expert consensus panel to discuss what is new and how should hyperkalemia be managed in the emergency department. So it was a nice paper, a nice review. And so I'd like to go through that today. Now, as we all know, hyperkalemia is a potentially life-threatening disorder, and it occurs in 1 to 10% of hospitalized patients, and as well as 2 to 3% of emergency department patients. So we literally can see this on nearly every shift. It's a quintessential emergency department diagnosis that all of us have to manage and stay up with. Now, there's a lot of abnormalities that can be found on the initial workup, as well as that we have to contend with when managing these patients, including cardiac arrhythmias and a few other problems. So the management options have changed slightly over the past few years. So the purpose of the author's review was to really bring together experts in all fields and create a multidisciplinary review in the recognition of management for hyperkalemia, specifically in the emergency department. So framing this from an ED perspective, which was kind of cool. So perhaps we'll start going through the initial presentation and diagnosis. Peter, walk us through kind of your approach and the author's recommended approach to early on management of these patients.
Great, John. Very happy to talk about the presentation and the diagnosis. You know, clinically, as John mentioned, it can present in any number of different ways. In healthy folks, potassium is absorbed in the GI tract, and then we excrete it via kidneys. In patients with hyperkalemia, the patient can be completely asymptomatic. And so we'll have no clue, and we find these as lab calls with emergent values often. In some cases, they can present with diffuse weakness or even cramping in some of those cases, but most likely on the weak side, and then can also be seen as flaccid paralysis. You can present as cardiac dysrhythmic events like the junctional rhythm that John mentioned. It can be sinusoidal patterns. It can be the hyperkalemic patterns. It can spur dysrhythmic events, and it can even present as cardiac arrest. We can also see it frequently with GI disturbances and abnormalities, nausea, vomiting, copious diarrhea, right? And so the diarrhea is a way to lose lots of K. So often, patients present very nonspecific symptoms, not wearing a banner that screams out hyperkalemia. And it's not until your testing or the alarm values come back that you identify it as a real problem. Although there's no real global definition of hyperkalemia, and this has to do with laboratory differences in assays, but the European Resuscitation Council is going to give us a definition. And that's going to be mild hyperkalemia as 5.5 to 5.9. So that gives us mild, and those are mill equivalents per liter. And then moderate, so we go from 5.5 to 5.9. So moderate is 6 to 6.5 mill equivalents per liter. And then we go severe, and severe is 6.5. Now, again, those are arbitrary numbers because you can have life-threatening hyperkalemia at 5.5, right? So we all know that. But for the purposes of categorization, they're using a mild, moderate, and severe. And again, severe greater than 6.5. When we talk about electrocardiograms and those changes, hyperkalemia decreases the transmembrane potassium gradient, leading to increased potassium conductance and shortening of the duration of the action potential. And as we all know, these changes with hyperkalemia can result in ST depression, can lead to peaked T waves, and as well as QT shortening. Okay, those are common. As the extracellular potassium continues to rise, both PR and QRS intervals begin to lengthen, and this can eventually progress to the EKG of doom or the sinusoidal or sine wave complex that precedes ventricular fibrillation or even leads to asystole. So other EKG abnormalities that can occur with hyperkalemia and are well documented include bradycardia, AV blocks, or actually new bundle branch blocks. So if you think about it, you can see a lot of different pictures with hyperkalemia. Not classically though, the ones that I wouldn't point to would be tachydysrhythmic events, but bradydysrhythmic events surely fall within the wheelhouse of hyperkalemia. It is important to note that although some have proposed that EKG changes are sequential, like predictable, this, then this, then this, your patient can skip it completely and go to sinusoidal patterns. So be aware of that. And that people think that you won't see these severe EKG changes with mild or moderate hyperkalemia, and you do. So it's not that predictable. So don't hang your hat on those mild, moderate, and severe to predict EKG changes for you either. And then treatment options. And there have been a couple of different changes with treatment options as of late for hyperkalemia, particularly over the last 10 years. And then we'll start discussing the treatment options, then go through potential treatment algorithms that's recommended in this author's text. Now, ultimately, the conceptual goal for managing hyperkalemia is first and foremost, after making the diagnosis, is to shift the excess extracellular potassium into the intracellular spaces. So think shift first, and then think eliminate. Let's get rid of this. But the elimination phase takes more time. So we're going to think quick shift, and then long-term eliminate and get things done. So now it's time to turn it over to Mike about medications for redistribution.
Thanks, Peter. Awesome, awesome discussion in terms of that clinical presentation and diagnosis. I would say just highlighting one pearl that you mentioned. I think we teach a lot about those EKG abnormalities. I think one thing that I've learned and read in a relatively recent article is that the finding that I think is associated with the highest in-hospital mortality is bradycardia. And I think that's what John's case or the patient that John presented, he came in with bradycardia. And just note that whether it's the in-service, the board exam question, and even in real life, if they're bradycardic and have hyperkalemia, that's bad. Now, in terms of medications, the two classes, as you mentioned, were redistribution and then elimination. Well, I'll turn things over to Rob for elimination momentarily, but let's just talk about the tried and true medications that we use for redistributing potassium when we get the lab value, the panic call, and then we've confirmed it to ensure it's not simply a hemolyzed lab specimen. And those three categories of meds are insulin-dextrose combination, beta-2 agonists, and then sodium bicarbonate. And in general, we'll turn to insulin and dextrose. And in terms of insulin action, recall that it lowers potassium values by activating the sodium-potassium ATPase and by moving sodium out of the cell and potassium back into the cell. Now, what about timing? This is important when we talk about redistribution of meds. Usually with the insulin dextrose combination, we'll start to see some decreases in serum potassium in about 15 minutes following the administration. But here it is a critical pitfall that I have actually committed within the past year. And that is you really need to pay attention to patients with renal insufficiency, whether it be acute kidney injury or CKD, and they're already euglycemic, be careful with the amount of insulin that you administer to those patients in combination with your dextrose, because that's going to hang on a little bit longer. And I have unfortunately made a patient hypoglycemic after giving probably a little bit too much insulin and dextrose for a very high potassium level. So there are some papers and studies I've seen and listened to some lectures about perhaps we actually just go with 5 units of insulin combined with dextrose rather than our typical 10 units of dextrose. And that may be just as efficacious. So whether you do that or not, definitely, as you're writing that order for insulin and dextrose, double check the patient's creatinine and think, should I be using a lower dose here of insulin? So big pitfall with that class or combination of meds. In terms of beta 2 agonists, so very similar mechanism. It shifts potassium into the cell by activation of that sodium potassium ATPase pump. But in a little bit in contrast to the insulin dextrose combination, the effect starts at about 30 minutes, peaks at about 60, and in general will decrease the serum potassium by about 1 milliequivalent per liter. And that usually lasts about 2 hours. And then finally, sodium bicarbonate. It essentially promotes the uptake of potassium into skeletal muscle by increasing intracellular sodium via the sodium bicarbonate cotransporter, and sodium hydrogen exchange in turn increases, once again, sodium potassium ATPase activity. Now, in terms of the effect and the timing of sodium bicarbonate, it typically reduces serum potassium by about a half a milliequivalent per liter, usually at about that 30-minute mark. But it tends to be, when you compare it head-to-head with insulin, a little less effective than insulin and a beta-2 agonist such as albuterol. Now, in terms of pitfalls, there are some recent literature that suggests that sodium bicarbonate actually may not be that efficacious in reducing serum potassium in the absence of a patient that has metabolic acidosis. And in fact, a recent Cochrane review, bicarbonate is actually not indicated in the acute treatment of hyperkalemia anymore, but can be considered when there is a concomitant acidosis. So those are some things on the insulin dextrose, beta 2 agonist, and sodium bicarbonate to redistribute that high potassium level. But Rob, ultimately, we got to get it out of the body. So how can we accomplish that?
Yeah, Mike. So again, it's critical to remember that all of the interventions that you just mentioned only redistribute potassium. And so for the definitive treatment of hyperkalemia, you definitely have to work on elimination of potassium from the body. And so there are a number of medications that you can use to accomplish this. The first is loop diuretics, which again would really be only useful in somebody who's making urine. You're not going to use a diuretic, of course, in somebody who's end-stage renal without production of urine. And the loop diuretic that you use, furosemide, bumetamide, or tosporsemide, doesn't really matter. I would just use a hearty dose of each. And these increase potassium secretion in the distal tubule. It's important to note the effect of diuretics on potassium. It takes a couple of hours for it to really take effect. So you're not going to get that immediate response that you're going to get with the other agents that Mike mentioned. Moving on to oral binders of potassium, these are probably the medication class that has had the most change because there's some new options in terms of oral binders. Historically, we've used sodium pyrostyrene sulfonate binders or KX-olate, but these binders can be problematic in your critically ill sort of hypotensive patient. The newer binders appear to be safe, but there's ongoing research into their safety. So if you're going to give KX-olate, I would give to the non-critically ill patient. You're not going to want to give this to somebody who's like in shock. And it acts by binding potassium in the GI tract. It's often given at a dose of 15 grams up to 4 times daily. And the effect lowers potassium by 1 milliequivalent in about 24 hours or sometimes longer. And it's really kind of better for your not critically ill hyperkalemia patient. It's important to recognize that fact. A couple of pitfalls with that. It slows GI motility and it can affect gut perfusion. So it can be associated with colonic ulcers, ischemia, and necrosis due to excessive crystal formation in these critically ill patients. Another point to note about KX-olate is the patient's going to wind up having diarrhea. So from a practical standpoint, you have to be able to manage that patient's diarrhea. Our nephrologists don't want us to give KX-olate when they're about to take them to dialysis because that becomes problematic. So be wary of that effect, the effect of diarrhea. Another agent is patiromer, which is spelled P-A-T-I-R-O-M-E-R. And this is a cation exchange resin that exchanges calcium for potassium. And it's effective for patients on ACE inhibitors, basically renin-angiotensin inhibitors. The effect and timing of this, it's really well tolerated acutely and chronically, and it's dosed at approximately 8.4 grams per day. And its onset of action is 2 to 7 hours after the first dose. So pateromir is going to be an agent that you're going to use for people who are on ACE inhibitors. The next agent is sodium zirconium cyclosilicate, has a cool brand name, Lokelma, L-O-K-E-L-M-A. And this selectively exchanges potassium for sodium in the intestine. And the effect and timing of this, in a large study of over 1,700 patients, it showed true effectiveness. A 10 milligram dose reduced potassium by 0.11 milliequivalents within an hour and by almost 1 milliequivalent by 48 hours. And it's typically given 3 times a day. Finally, there's hemodialysis or renal replacement therapy. This remains a treatment of choice for potassium elimination in your critically ill patient. The effect and timing, K is removed over hours, but it's extremely effective. Of course, you're going to have a dialysis catheter or if the patient has a shunt for this. So that can delay your institution of this mechanism of elimination. But it really is a definitive mechanism that you're going to reach for in patients who are on dialysis. I would say for patients who are on dialysis, probably should not mess with the other agents. You really just should get them straight to dialysis if possible.
Yeah, that's a great summary, Rob. I think all of us have had an experience. I remember going back to Mike with your shifter about insulin dextrose. I remember there was one patient who I nearly intubated because they were hypoglycemic, and it was as a resident, and I had given them insulin glucose and they had a history of CKD, and I got pulled out from sign out because the nurse was like, this patient's altered, they're diaphoretic. And I was in the middle of sign out and what is going on? And I'm like, oh my goodness, I had just given them insulin glucose, but I hadn't given them enough glucose and their sugar was undetectable. And it was probably fine before that, but it's definitely a pitfall that I've fallen into when managing, you know, a really sick patient. And Rob, with the 100%, I had to laugh when you were talking about the oral binders and the diarrhea. I can imagine the disaster that could ensue up in the dialysis suite as a patient develops diarrhea and can't leave the machine because they're plugged in, they're getting dialysis and then have to go to the bathroom. Definitely an important point out of respect for our colleagues as well as the patients, to not put them in a vulnerable position there. But certainly not giving these oral binders in critically ill patients is an important point because it can have some serious consequences if their gut is already poorly perfused, that it may not be able to move it along and can develop gut necrosis. There are probably over 30 case reports of gut necrosis after KX-late administration in critically ill patients. So not something I'm routinely using either in my patients who are really sick, focusing really on moving them towards dialysis when necessary. So going back to the paper, the authors did a nice job summarizing all this, and they put together a very simple algorithm for how to approach hyperkalemia. And they start with really the first step, which is probably obvious, but as Mike mentioned, making sure that it's not spurious. Certainly a poor blood sample draw from a poorly running peripheral IV or patients with other problems can develop a spurious hyperkalemia. So clinical context is important here. And if it doesn't fit, send the retest. Now, as Peter mentioned, the EKG really is going to be the most important element to decide on early treatment while you're waiting for that number to come back. If there's EKG changes, then ultimately there is a cardiovascular impact of that patient's hyperkalemia. And while we didn't mention it because it really doesn't involve the fix of the extracellular potassium, patients with EKG changes are the ones that need calcium. And so that stabilizes the cardiac membrane and oftentimes will restore some normality to that EKG. And so the authors here recommend a gram of calcium gluconate through the peripheral IV. And the reason why calcium gluconate, which is about a third as potent as calcium chloride, is that it's less injurious to tissue should you get extravasation. So calcium chloride in general is kind of held in the cases of the patient has a central line, or if you do have a patient with a very severe hyperkalemia, you can still use it, but just be careful. Now, finally, in step three, they move along to, okay, let's shift and plan to eliminate this potassium. So if the potassium is less than 6, the authors recommend starting off with your insulin dextrose combination beta agonist and consider those oral binders, because in theory, this patient probably isn't super sick. For elimination, you can also consider Lasix or fluids based on, you know, your clinical evaluation of the patient's volume status, cardiac function, and renal function. Now, if you're in that moderate category of potassium of 6 to 6.5, in addition to all of your initial shifters and plans for elimination, you might want to consider hemodialysis. This seems to be a threshold above 6 when maybe there's something more serious going on and it's going to take some time for that potassium to come down. And I can tell you, if I have EKG changes, I also have a close hand on the phone to call my nephrologist to think, this patient might be in trouble. And if that potassium's over 6.5, I'm certainly giving a buzz to my local friendly nephrologist to say, hey, I think this patient's really sick. They may need more urgent hemodialysis, so perhaps we should do some planning here. Now, certainly reassessment's important. So the final step is every 2 to 4 hours, it's probably a good idea to resend your BNP. Just based off the timing of the effectiveness of these medications, we expect to see some effect within the first 30 minutes of our potassium shifters. So within an hour or two, that repeat BNP is going to be important. But certainly to determine the duration of effect and how well the patient's progressing, at least every 4 hours, resending a lab value. If the potassium is still greater than 6 on that repeat test, again, think about where the trajectory of your patient's going and whether or not they may need extracorporeal renal replacement therapy. So final points here. I think this is a classic emergency medicine diagnosis and something we're presented with often. So it's good to take a quick review of some of the more novel oral agents that can be used to eliminate potassium. Insulin and dextrose still remains as probably the most effective treatment to immediately shift your potassium intracellularly while you work on elimination. But as we all can remember, please, please, please remember that hypoglycemia is common, particularly in patients with renal dysfunction. Oral elimination agents have historically been avoided in critically ill patients, but perhaps some of these newer agents may be more effective and safer in our really, really sick patients. And for patients with refractory hyperkalemia or potassium greater than 6.5, that seems to be a good trigger to consult your nephrologist early to consider early hemodialysis. So thanks, guys. Thanks for going through that with me. It's always good to get back to the basics, but this was a fun review.
Well, John, thanks for taking us through this discussion on I think it's a very nice article that just came out from an expert panel consensus and very, very stepwise, logical, thoughtful treatment of an electrolyte disorder that we know can kill. We've all had those patients that present with refractory cardiac arrest. And despite maximal therapy, you know, we finally get that back after we've called the code and the K is greater than 10. So a life-threatening electrolyte abnormality, we see it every day, we treat it. But these are some very important pearls and pitfalls that we went through. So thanks for emceeing this discussion. And thanks to all of you for listening to this podcast. We very much appreciate the discussion that you have with us in person at things like ASAP, and also the questions that you send in electronically through the website. So with that, we'll bring this podcast to a close, and we will very much look forward to talking to you on our next podcast. Bye for now.